Coming up on the Travis Makes Friends podcast.
I believe we're all blessed with a God-given talent. And the moment that board touched my hand, I knew that like that was going to be what I would do for the rest of my life.
It was certainly coupled with like rebellious behavior.
Yeah, which makes complete sense why I ended up a heroin addict. Miller High Life used to sponsor Jackass, and they'd literally have to rent out like two extra hotel rooms for all the Miller High Life. The more outrageous my behaviors were, the more outlandish my antics became.
Yeah.
The higher the ratings went, the more in demand I was, the more money I made. And if the stunt was crazy enough and I got hurt, I was taken to the hospital where a doctor would write me a script of what I really wanted, which was pain pills, and everyone allowed me to do that. It was a justifiable high.
Yeah, right.
And I did it while working. You know, the point of Jackass is to do things terribly wrong. So the worse the stunt went, the better, like, of an applause you got.
Right.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends.
Charles Manson, he didn't kill anybody.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, he maybe in his life, but when the ones that he like was convicted for when they went to the house and killed all those people, like he just gave instructions but never left his house.
That's
pretty fucking intelligent to get into someone's mind that much to make them that much of a believer of a cause that you'll kill for it.
Yeah, you think it's more the leader just being that charismatic, or you think it's more the people being that gullible?
I think it's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
Just a mixture of, you know, a really, what some might call overbearing, charismatic, insane genius. You know, because crazy is crazy until it finds its context, then it becomes brilliant.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think every
brilliant person was crazy before they were brilliant.
Legit. Yeah. The Wright brothers, when they fucking invented the plane.
Yeah.
Before that plane was invented and the first plane flew,
Tell
me you're going to invent something that flies and transports it. Fuck you. You're insane.
Well, it's actually a marker of mastery and brilliance is being crazy for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was reading, I think it was 10X is greater than 2X, a book by Ben Hardy and Dan Sullivan, these business guys.
We were just talking about that.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And one of the things in there that they talked about that, like probably one of the biggest, one of my favorite sections of the book, they talk about the difference between excellence and mastery, I think it was. Basically, like you can get really good at something by just duplicating what other people have done and just going in, duplicating a process, learning from somebody else, and then doing exactly what they said to do. You can get really good at something. But it's like the true masters, innovators of their crafts always at some point like brought in their own uniqueness to stuff that's already been existing and created something that's completely brand new and were thought of as they were doing it as being crazy at that time until it ends up working out and then they're geniuses.
And they're praised by all.
And this is probably not the best example right now, but Kanye West was that way. You know,
like
he was delusional about how he was going to be the greatest rapper ever and he's going to be this insane, crazy artist. And he was saying all this stuff before anybody knew who he was. So at the time, like all these, you know, big producers are like, who's this kid coming in telling us that he's going to be this or whatever. But then he goes and creates this stuff that nobody heard before and it took off and he became brilliant. And now he's kind of back in the crazy chair.
Or is he?
Yeah.
Or is he just back in the lab creating this new, like,
we'll see,
next level experience that we're going to be like, we're the fools in that equation.
Yeah, right.
Time will tell.
Time will tell. That's for sure.
The new Dave Chappelle documentary. Did you watch that?
I didn't know.
I watched it the other night. And
it was a documentary
not a documentary. His new special.
Oh, yeah. His special. I watched that. Yeah.
And how he ended that. The brilliance
Yeah.
of the dreamer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dude.
I'll fuck this up. I'm not even going to pretend to,
yeah, me, I was gonna
to
say,
say
yeah.
what he
sure.
said. I
just
wish
watch
I could.
The special.
I'd sound really profound, like I knew my deal if I did, but watch it. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant how he ties
that's what
that
makes
together.
Him so good, man. He's more like an orator than he is a comedian. You know, he's just like, he's so good at distilling truth and making you laugh about it and then uncovering it as the truth. You know what
totally.
I mean? Like he says something that you think is just like, oh, that's utterly ridiculous and it's made up and you're laughing your ass off and it's like, but that's what you do. You know, and you're like, oh.
He ties it all together at the end, full
like,
circle.
That's true.
And then, you know, talking about these dreamers and making the impossible possible, if you will, the most profound, prolific takeaways from this knowledge acquired wisdom experienced is from the failure, right?
Yeah, right.
Like really,
yeah.
Which is, you know, was skateboarding for me.
Okay.
Skateboarding was it. Skateboarding weeds out the quitters.
Oh,
absolutely.
Dude. Well, I mean, cement has a really interesting way of giving you feedback.
Yeah.
You know
what I mean?
So.
I don't know if I'd say interesting, but it's a way.
Yeah.
But you know, for skateboarders, myself, you know. Failure is not an option. No is unacceptable. And we will relentlessly, tirelessly try a trick, one trick, over and over and over. And it will take days, weeks, months, years for that matter sometimes. And then we get it and it's just, on to the next.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's...
What got you into skateboarding?
Opportunity met timing.
Yeah.
And...
How old were you?
And this pro skater being smitten on my sister.
Okay.
And my sister took me to the skate park at 7 I have no idea. In Ocean City, Maryland, 3rd Street. We go there. My sister could care less about skateboarding. She never has, never will. But nonetheless, we end up at this skate park and I remember this pro skater. I have no idea who he is. I was a kid at the time. But he gave me his skateboard. And looking back in hindsight, he was clearly just trying to fuck my sister. and hats off to him. But I believe we're all blessed with a God-given talent. But God may not have... I could have been the best ping pong player in the world, but God may have never seen fit to put a paddle in my hand.
Sure, sure.
That day, for whatever the reason was, and the moment that board like touched my hand as this glass is... I knew that like that was going to be what I would do for the rest of my life.
Who were some of the like big pros at that time?
At that time, it was the Bones Brigade, all like the PAL team, Steve Caballero, Tony Hawk, Mike McGill, Lance Mountain, and who ultimately I ended up riding for. And I got on by way of a guy named Bucky Lasek, who was like the guy who came after the original Bones Brigade, who was also from Baltimore, and kind of took me under his wing.
This is like the beginning of the sport still.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, like, those guys were like inventing it.
Oh,
as
they were the
pioneers. Going. Yeah. I mean,
they were looked
like,
at as crazy. They were crazy.
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah, for sure. And they were looked at as crazy because, like, they were literally inventing the sport.
Totally.
Like, they were every single aspect of there was no foundation, there was no rule book or playbook
or reference of, like, if you do this, you can maybe acquire this.
Totally. That's why I was saying, like, what would it even mean to be pro at that? Like, do you, like, if you just get a sponsorship deal, does that mean you're all of a sudden pro? Like, what did that even mean back then?
It just depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And unfortunately, I wasn't of the age to know what that looked like then.
Because technically, like being professional, anything is to get paid to do
well,
something.
Well, it's funny that you say that because on one of these social media platforms I follow, a big one in the skateboarding world, it might have been the Barracks.
Okay.
And they said, what do you consider a pro to be? Like, what's it take for you to be considered a pro skateboarder today? And people were weighing in and it was... Some was just a name on a skateboard. Some was a name on a board with an official video part through the people who, you know, make the board.
It's just
all these different qualifications. Some were, can you provide a living for your family through it?
Mm-hmm.
But I know a lot of pro skaters today, not a lot, but I know a handful who also have part-time jobs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's what I was curious is like, it's basically still really an opinion. It's kind of up in the air. Like
it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, skateboarding was the thing where like you'd be kicked out of most places for doing it.
Yeah.
You know, destruction of property. And that's,
it was certainly coupled with like rebellious behavior, yeah,
which makes complete sense why I ended up a heroin addict.
Okay, but what was the chicken? What was the egg? Totally. You know what I'm saying? Like,
no. But the funny thing is, the irony in all that is now today it's become an Olympic sport, and it's welcomed by all, viewed by everyone,
revered,
and it's like wanted, and it's just crazy how things,
yeah. Like Sean Wyatt was snowboarding.
Yeah. Who was also an insanely amazing skater.
Is he that like as good legit, as...
Yeah, he was like up there with Hawk. Yeah, but I think he's now more focusing just on snowboarding stuff, I believe. The Johnny Shilleroff, the guy who created Element Skateboards,
mm-hmm.
Who then sold Element to Billabong,
okay.
Created the Heart Supply, which is... essentially, you know, if he wants, I guess, could create it into something as big as Element was.
Mm.
But it's his next project, which is who I ride for now,
okay,
and who I just put a video part out with, and my first pro model. Because when I fell into addiction, it was around the same time that I was designing my prototype shape for PAL.
Okay.
And I was like staying at Tony Hawk's house during the summer and like really invested in that world. But I chose to pursue heroin as opposed to a skateboarding career.
Mm.
Needless to say, my life went to shit and I had given that dream away.
Yeah.
And fast forward to coming up on 9 years sober at 45 years old, I went to Barcelona and filmed like a legit skate part and put it out. And it's the best video part I've ever put out, paired with a board. And now Johnny Shilleroff, who originally owned Element that sold to Billabong, now created the Heart Supply, is the official team captain for the USA Olympic skateboarding team.
Oh, no.
He's the head of the Olympics skateboarding section.
Gotcha, like the division or whatever.
Yeah, the division, yeah.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
So it's pretty crazy to, I don't even think about that until just talking to you about it, the evolution and the layers that not only has it went through, but I paired with it and the trajectory. But again, skateboarding is kind of the thing that instilled in me my core beliefs today.
You know? Like the values that you hold.
Yeah.
I noticed in your book, so this is Dream Seller, an addiction memoir by Brandon Novak. If you haven't picked it up, you should go pick up a copy. Just the very first couple of pages, I noticed you dedicated the book to your mom.
Yeah.
Talk to me about mom's role in the very beginning. Because again, at the time, skateboarding's not a revered. It's not what it is today,
for sure. And you were definitely an outcast.
Yeah, and no parent wants to see their kid go down a path that's maybe like less trustworthy or less dependable or stable or whatever, mm-hmm. regardless of what that path is. But especially probably not this like new sport that nobody knew what the future looked like with it, where there wasn't a lot of examples of people doing it successfully, where it was also associated with a rebellious attitude and could potentially lead to hanging out with bad people and could get you on this path. What did mom think during that whole time?
It's really funny that you just broke it down like that, especially meeting you today, seeing your family downstairs, and you're a family man, and you clearly, that's very near and dear to your heart and my family wasn't like your family.
Okay.
And that's really cool if you think about it, because there's just all these different people out there that come from so many different backgrounds that give us different perspectives on the same exact topic.
Yeah.
Right? Like you and I could be going to the museum and staring at a Picasso painting and having two completely different takeaways from that.
Sure.
And for me as a child growing up, so what it looked like is I had a father who was around just enough to let us know he was not around.
Mm.
He never held a job a day in his life. And he taught me one thing, if and when I went to prison, how to conduct myself. And, and he was a biker. He ran with the Hells Angels.
Okay.
Ultimately became addicted to crack cocaine and his body shut down. He passed away. But needless to say, during that time, received the first skateboard, 7, growing up. My mother got her very first job at Mercy Hospital in Baltimore City at 15 years old, drawing blood, a phlebotomist, drawing blood for $5 a pop. And that's how she would make her money. Mm. But she was doing that to support schooling because she was working her way up that social ladder, if you will, to ultimately become a nuclear physicist on the board of that hospital.
Oh, wow.
So she is working day in, day out, tirelessly.
Yeah.
I have a father who's just a maniac.
Yeah.
A brother and a sister who are older than me, and they're starting to like go off to school and college.
Okay.
So my mother, like her biggest fear was having to go to work from 4 a.m. till 9 p.m. and leave me home with him.
Mm.
So she got me the skate. Well, she, the moment I got that skateboard, she would take me into work with her, and I was raised skating the parking lot of Mercy Hospital.
Oh, wow.
And then just kind of bouncing from department to department because that was better than the alternative, which was my crazy biker dad taking me to the strip joint all day while I sold meth and did God knows what with the chicks.
Right.
So for her, she was like, yes,
yeah, like
he found something. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So that
the
was
whole idle hands thing.
Legit.
Yeah. Especially for teenagers.
And then when the older guys, I was blessed with that talent and people started recognizing it. So I was the youngest kid in the crew and the older guys, Bucky Lasix and all the others would like come pick me up and take me skating with them. And so that's, my mother didn't have money to pay for a babysitter.
Yeah.
So that was free daycare for me. And I was around guys that like had goals, they had aspiration, they had dreams, although it wasn't the norm of like maybe you should play football and get a scholarship to college.
Yeah.
It was still better than the alternative that I had.
Yeah. It was still, to your point earlier, it's still instilling values.
Yeah.
It's still teaching hard work. It's still teaching accomplishing things. It's still teaching persistence. It's still teaching a lot of really, you know, valuable life skills.
Which then transcended into my world of sobriety.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to me at the time.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
And then I, you know, at this point I've kind of learned that like because of those values and ethics that a board on four wheels that people thought were like insane at one point became a way that I envisioned everything that I approach in life. And that is simply that mentality will create reality. I was always the guy that if I can believe it, I can see it, not the other way around.
Yeah.
Because I was the one that dared to be crazy enough to step outside the social norm and not just fucking fall in line.
Sure.
Not to say that anything's wrong with that. Not at all. Not, I would never. I respect that just as much as anything else.
Totally.
But that was just where I was.
So during high school, were you just completely concerned and focused on skateboarding? Like no thought about school, academics or anything like that? It was basically just like, how can I get out of here to go skateboard?
All day. I ate it. I breathed it. I slept it. I dreamt it.
Yeah.
I remember.
So it was the goal to become pro.
Yeah. There was no reason for like a plan B, a trait or an option.
Yeah.
Never thought twice.
Yeah.
Like straight up one, you know, and again, talking out loud about this is making me realize the synchronicity here is a trait that I possessed at that age with skateboarding followed me into my addiction and alcoholism, which was despite any and all adverse consequences that came my way, I was going to do what I had to do to get what I wanted to get.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked with skateboarding. And then I chose to pursue drugs and used it in the same format, but then in sobriety it kept full circle.
Right. Yeah, the value or the quality was persistent there. It was just the pursuit that was incorrect.
Legit. Yeah.
At what point did you start getting into the drug scene? Did that fall into the skateboarding world at all? Did those coincide, or did was none of that relevant?
It wasn't really relevant. So what I believed, and I'm asked this often, is where did it come from? Where did it spawn from? Right. My mother was a nuclear physicist. My brother is an attorney who works in the White House, practices pensions and benefits. My father was a drug addict who died. And so I came from better. I knew better. I knew right from wrong. But my father and his father were addicts and alcoholics. So I believed that I was genetically predisposed.
Sure. Yeah.
And then,
which
you
is
know,
real.
Yeah. 100%. And then my brother and sister, who are both from a different father, have no issue.
Oh, really? Interesting.
My mother, no issue. Hmm. Me, can't get enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was all it was, just like start drinking or whatever, and then that's not enough, and then start doing this, that's not enough, get down to this.
Everything progressively just happens faster and gets worse in my life when I'm doing things that I have no business doing.
Well, it sounds like when you're doing anything, even if you do have business doing it, my point is like, it sounds like you go all in on whatever
you're
doing.
For sure. I've never been that guy.
But that can be in a destructive way if it's something that's destructive.
Legit. I was never that guy that kind of dipped my toe in the shallow end to see how the temperature felt. Mm. But ultimately, that hurt me for a long time when it came to sobriety. Because when I know I'm jumping back and forth, but we're just saying a lot of parallels here that it just doesn't make sense not to speak on. But when I was toying with the idea or image of recovery and sobriety, I would go to those meetings and kind of peek my head in to see what they had going on and dip my toe in the shallow end to see if the temperature was right. And all I was doing, A, was prolonging the inevitable. B, procrastinating, right? And they taught me in my journey, procrastination is like masturbation. You only fuck yourself. So I'm just like royally fucking myself. But when things got great for me is when I just ran to that deep end and jumped headfirst and submerged myself.
Clothes
like
on.
Up all of it, dude. Exactly. Couldn't get there quick enough because the fire was so hot, if you will.
Mm. Yeah.
Pain.
That's kind of what ended up happening.
Yeah.
Basically just like, I can't take it anymore.
Totally. The pain.
Like if I follow this path to conclusion, it's not going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
And my only alternate path here is no longer like, oh, let me just like only do this on the weekends, or let me just only do this day or that day.
Legit.
It's like, it's 100% clean.
And I had tried to do that for so long.
Yeah.
And
you tell yourself it's cool. Like,
yeah,
you know, I'll just do that on Saturday nights or whatever.
Exactly. Well, what I was doing was just rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. Right. And I'd put this character here to play this part on this day when the weather's here and she's and that's why I'm really, really big on in allowing everyone to have their process. Because, see, I fucked around. I acquired a lot of knowledge. I'm too smart for my own good a lot of the times, which, again, is another reason why it took me so long to get better, is because the pain would be great enough where it would become unbearable. I'd reach out and ask for help, and I'd land myself in a seat that literally had the ability to save my life of whatever treatment center, doctor's office, psych office. And I would outthink myself right out of it.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it didn't get better for me until I dumbed my way into this position.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I had to really just
simplify it.
Legit. Yeah. And because prior, again, to getting sober, everything that my mind told me was that like to fight was to win. To fight was to survive. To fight was to make it through another day. To fight was to get one more drink or drug.
Yeah.
Which is right. But then I come into recovery or sobriety and to fight is to die.
Hmm.
To fight is to relapse.
Yeah.
To fight is to lose. So it was a complete mind fuck.
Yeah, right.
So I had to understand that. And I never did until I did.
That's kind of always the question with this kind of stuff, right? Is like, can you truly help somebody else get to that point, or does every person have to get to that point themselves?
So that's my process, had to be my process. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer in allowing everyone to experience their process, because, and everything I know today, I did not know then.
Yeah.
Life is all in retrospect and minds
unfortunately.
Live. Hindsight, 20, minds live forward and learn backwards. And now looking back, if anyone would have robbed me of one night of being homeless or one less act that I committed illegally to acquire drugs, I very well do not believe I'd be the child of God that I am today, who's literally devoted his life in helping others who are where I once was.
Yeah.
And like, so I'm a firm believer of repercussions from actions and allowing people to experience outcomes from behaviors that they're exhibiting, good, bad, or indifferent. And then we just meet them where they're at.
Where do you think, this might be opening a can of worms here, so just let me know, but where do you land on like the decriminalization of most drugs, of most illegal substances?
Yeah, great question.
It seems like there should be some give on this, because oftentimes you might propel yourself into further illegal activity just due to the fact that what you're acquiring is illegal, not necessarily because that drug is going to be worse than the other one. I don't know if that question makes sense, but tell me what your thoughts are on that.
I get it. And again, you know, one thing that I always do is remain very neutral. So like, if I'm the definition of Switzerland right now, I'm not a debater. I debate it for a lot of years and I shot heroin for a lot of years. What I do know is my experience and I'm married to my narrative because it's mine and it's worked for me. And what mine looks like is, do I believe we can arrest our way out of the problem? Absolutely not.
Yeah,
right. That's one of the reasons why I'm the keynote speaker for the DEA. The DEA came to me and they believed that I could be part of the solution to this drug epidemic, which is insane as that may sound. The DEA pays me to speak at their fucking events that they throw all over the nation.
Yeah.
The opioid summit, the 360-degree opioid summit. But they came to me and they said, we understand we cannot arrest our way out of the problem.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. You can't. So that's one side of it. But that contradicts kind of what I just said. If I didn't have those nights spent in a cold jail cell, sleeping on the floor next to the toilet as an inmate's pissing, and I have to use some old wadded up toilet paper as a pillow, freezing cold, I don't know if I would have realized how severe my problem was.
Sure.
And it wasn't like that arrest alone single-handedly allowed me to have this come to Jesus moment, like, I'm done, I'll never turn back. Fuck no. Yeah. What I know to be true today is that I ultimately got sober by a series of me being divinely inconvenienced.
Hmm.
So do I believe that you can arrest your way out of the problem? Absolutely not. But I do believe in repercussions from actions.
Sure.
Would I stop if I have a nice home to go home to and a bed to sleep in and a woman to help me with life and a fridge? Like, I don't know.
But if you follow that through too, though, I mean, you're going to have a ton of, those consequences are still going to exist. They're just not going to be held by the state and maybe not as, like blatantly connected to the crime itself, if that makes sense. Like, so like you might have other social consequences because you're doing drugs, but like, because a judge doesn't like swing the gavel and go like, you're guilty of this thing, therefore you have to serve this time for this thing. You don't really like correlate the causality. You like in your mind, you're not thinking about like, oh, well, this relationship that I had with my really good friend is now broken and that hurts
me. The ripple effect.
Because of this problem that I can't seem to tackle. But like I said, if the judge isn't swinging the gavel and saying you're guilty of this and this is your punishment, sometimes you just don't correlate those two things.
You're ignorant to it.
Yeah.
Why would you?
Yeah, me and my buddy were just estranged right now. You know what I mean? You're not going like, it's because I did this and it's 100%, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it's like, there's still going to be consequences. It's just maybe not as like, in your face, this is why you're experiencing these consequences.
So that's why I love platforms like this, right? Because most people aren't aware that's even the reality of the situation. Therefore, ignorance is bliss.
Sure.
So why would you not continue to repeat those behaviors that equate to those same outcomes and think that you just had a bad day or that like, if something just would have been a little, you know, whatever, however, but so, a platform like this allows us to come on and shed light on which most people would generally say is a dark topic.
Sure.
And what happens is people acquire some information. They're armed with the facts. Ignorance is no longer bliss. And it never stood a chance until I uncovered the problem in order to discover what the problem even was, if there was any hopes for me to recover from the problem.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to kind of get into it. And that's what's amazing about things like this. And ultimately, what you find out, what I found out, is that it has nothing to do with the drug or the alcohol or the porn or the gambling or the sex or the food or the shopping. That's not the problem. It is not. It's the exact opposite. Quite the contrary. It's the solution. It's the answer to the problem, which is the behaviors, the thinking, the attitude, and the behavior that continues to take me back to the solution, which is why now it's a wash, rinse, repeat. Because if I simply just sit this down or that down, It's not a matter of if, but when I return. Why? Because I haven't worked on the problem. The thinking is the problem, not the drinking. The thinking takes me back to that.
Where along the path do things be... It's difficult to phrase this question, and I've had difficulty kind of parsing through this concept, which is why I like talking about it. So we grew up, to your point, like different, wildly different. So I grew up Southern California.
Sure.
So literally opposite sides of the country.
Yeah.
I grew up very, very religious, like overly religious, almost cultish bubble type religion. You grew up with a dad who's in a biker gang, who's on drugs, who's strung out, and then your mom's trying to do this. You're like, you're trying to get out of the house. You got all these different influences persuading you to do things or not persuading you to do things. And I grew up in this like just protected bubble. So to that degree, when we were raised, we weren't really a product of our choices at that point. We were a product of our environment because you don't have a choice of what family you get born into, what your circumstances are, what hand the world deals you when you're brought into the world. But I love the phrase, when you're born, you look like your parents. When you die, you look like your choices.
Wow, but I love that.
My question is, at what point along the way do the choices overtake the environment? Right, because it's obvious. Like you were probably more genetic, not just genetically predisposed to like getting addicted, but also like with a dad like that and a strange relationship with a dad. Like there's so many reasons why you would have found the path of drugs before somebody who grew up like I did would find that path. But at some point, it's still your choice.
Totally.
And at some point, you ultimately will need to make the decision, even if you had all these other circumstances, even if it might have been easier for you to do this thing or more difficult or whatever the case may be. At some point, you are 100% responsible for the choices that you make on a day-to-day basis. I guess my question is like, at what point does it switch? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's hard to hold the 13-year-old accountable for something that happened. It's just like, oh man, well, you got dealt a shitty hand. And like, I don't know if I would have done anything different in that situation. I probably would have done the same exact goddamn thing. So like, where along the way do I, you know,
totally.
Does responsibility pick up?
Amazing question. And to add some complexity to that as if it needs any more. As a kid growing up, it was very clear to me and easy to see the effects alcohol and drugs have on a human being, mm-hmm. right? Because my father, Jerome, everyone loved Jerome. He was a great guy. Mm. But when he didn't show up at 5:30 to make dinner, he was a really good cook. We knew he was at Pappas's bar, shutting the bar down with his biker buddies, and we heard him and his biker friends pouring the parking lot at 3:30, and the key hit the lock. We shook like leaves because we were about to endure some shit that no one should ever have to witness. So I could understand the psychic change that takes place in an individual upon ingesting a drink or a drug, right? The Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I witnessed it at a very young age, and I made it a point to excel at everything I did to prove why I would never become that fucking man. Mm. That was my mission, my life, my goal. That was it.
Yeah.
And it worked really well until I became, not only did I become that man, I became him tenfold. Mm. And the choices that then became this lifestyle and outcome paired perfectly with my progression of my alcoholism and addiction. The more I drank, the more I drugged, the more I became disconnected to reality, and it progressively got worse. And as an alcoholic, once I drink or drug, I lose the privilege to have a say-so about how things go in my life. And then it becomes my reality.
Yeah.
And my reality is so much different than yours. That for me now, the abnormal is the normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Which is living in these conditions where at one point it was a choice.
Yeah.
But now I'm so disconnected from reality and or abnormality that like you and I are staring at the same painting having two completely different reactions.
Yeah, sure.
And you could... You'll never really understand it until you understand it. And I, you know, it's again, we're going deep here. I wouldn't wish addiction on my worst enemy, but I'm going to sit here and tell you it's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What do you do with that? Yeah. That's how struggle works, right? It's like you wouldn't wish any struggle.
That's the full circle moment right here.
Exactly.
The failure that turns into the success that I wouldn't wish on anybody. But like I had that moment of clarity and the spiritual experience that allowed me to become a completely different wired person who not only acts, but more importantly, reacts to things differently, that now my alcoholism, my addiction is a superhuman power that I possess that sets me apart from so many others.
Yeah, I love how you said that, not act, but react better.
Yeah.
That's a loaded statement, man. Like that's it.
Yeah.
Like that is it. Anybody that's having trouble making decisions right now, you're probably blaming a lot of it on external things, mm-hmm. environment, or this person, or this friend of mine, or this situation happened at work, and I just couldn't, life is just stressful right now. Whatever you're telling yourself, it's not about the acting, it's about the reacting. And you can't control what life sends your way, but you can control how you react to what life sends your way. And that's ultimately where the Brandons are made.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, and I learned that through my program of recovery and sobriety. I got into the work. And it told me, right, because the last thing I, as an addict or an alcoholic, ever wants to do is assume responsibility for my actions. Ooh, the name of my game is I deflect, I justify, and I minimize.
Yep.
Right? Because God forbid we look at me for me. Mm. And then I get into the work, I buy into the process and solution of recovery, what sobriety looks like, and they tell me that... because I'm already cut from the cloth that if it doesn't make sense to me, it's wrong, right? Like, so I'm already having, I'm up against some shit already right out of the gate. I already have a misconstrued conception of reality. But then I'm also quick to become that victim, right? Mm. It's if you didn't do this, I wouldn't have been here or whatever it is.
Right.
And then what I learned in recovery is that the moment I place an expectation on you, a person, place, or a thing, it's not a matter of if, but when you'll let me down. Mm. So what do I know an expectation is today? It's an unfulfilled resentment, right? Because why? I cannot control your actions. What I can control is my reaction to your action, right? So they told me a resentment is an number one offender to an alcoholic. It will take us back to a drink. Hmm. And to drink is to die, right? This is the teachings that we live by.
Sure.
So understanding that, knowing that I cannot control you, what I learned is that all I have control over in this world is my thinking, my attitude, and my behavior.
Yeah.
So the sooner I learn that, the easier and lighter my world is to navigate through. And I accept you for wherever you're at. Why? Because acceptance is the answer to everything in our program.
Well, and that is, it is the most empowering feeling when you finally like really take hold of that concept, because victimhood is the opposite of empowerment.
Totally. Right?
If everything is always somebody else's fault, the environment, the culture, the politics, your mom, your dad, your cousin, your friend, everything's always somebody else's fault. Then how do you expect to be able to make any improvement in your life?
Yeah, there's no change.
Yeah,
everything will stay the exact same.
You can't do anything about it. If nothing's your fault, you can't do anything to improve it. You just have to hope that the universe gifts you improvement, which is not how it works.
People love to fucking relinquish that. You know, I can't do anything about it because
bad.
You're the problem
exactly.
here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Except responsibility.
It doesn't feel good to be like, oh, yeah, I was dealt a shitty hand. Yeah, I probably like... might have had this path may have been like easier for me to follow. And yeah, I could get resentful about maybe some other people who had an easier path, but it's like the bottom line is the cards are the cards.
Yeah.
What are you going to do about it now is the question, because you can't go back and change the cards.
No.
You know what I'm saying? Like you can't ask life for a different hand. You know what I mean? Like you get dealt the hand that you get dealt, and eventually you have to play that hand the best you possibly can and take ownership and responsibility for the actions that you take moving forward. And that's the only version that will empower you to live a life that you actually want to live.
Yeah. That you believe is worth like getting up for.
Yes, exactly.
You know, for so long, I was trying to fill this internal void. with an external solution. And it came by way of like money, property, and prestige. Hmm. And it always would divert me from what my primary purpose was, which was simply to just make it through another day early on in sobriety, sober. And then what I realized is, because I always believed that the home was big enough, the car was new enough, the woman was pretty enough, and the account was high enough, I had to be doing well.
Yeah.
But internally, I did not have that life that I believe was worth getting out of bed for every morning. Never wanted to die more in my life. So finally, at the end, after I had exhausted all of those opportunities, options, and resources, rearranged all the pieces that were possible and all the places that existed, I did the one thing I had never done. I went inside. Hmm. I went inside. I dug deep inside. And what happened was I finally, it was the, as per usual in my life, the last thing I tried that was the first thing that worked. And I did the internal work that was required to today achieve those external results that I've always fucking desired for so, so long. Because I went from a frame of mind of just problem. So consumed by the mess that I was incapable of seeing the message. Problem. And then I surrounded myself with some really like-minded, intelligent individuals who really had a grasp on what the fuck I was up against and could guide me into the right direction, promised land, if you will. And at that moment, acquiring the knowledge, I went from being the problem to literally like living in the solution. Mm-hmm. So on the days where I wake up and would like to take that problematic stance, I can't, because I've acquired so much knowledge that it's impossible for me to stay stuck in this ignorant state. Hmm. Like I can't it's not like I'm like, oh, but man, like
you're
shut
so
the
hyper
fuck.
Aware.
What the fuck are you? Yeah, I know goddamn well that like I'm choosing to stay stuck on stupid.
Yeah,
like this is of all fault of my own, right? Because they told me, if you're not happy with the position you're in, take a look at who put you there.
Yeah.
And that fucking thing hurt when I heard that first. Yeah, because exactly. I really wanted to like blame it on the both ex-fiancés.
Yeah.
But they're exes for a reason. Exactly. No, I bought that, man.
Right. So, I think I have a pretty clear understanding of the kind of the timeline now. And now it's been 9 years sober, you said?
In May, it will be 9.
Congrats on that.
God
That's
willing,
awesome.
Yeah.
Where is Jackass in all of this stuff that we've been talking about, from time that you're, you know, a kid, you're skating, and then there's addiction, and then there's sobriety? Where does Jackass
that
come
in? That comes in, again, my timeline is really blurred, but in the mid-20s, it starts kind of.
Okay. Is this pre-addiction or
no,
like during?
No, during. During, yeah. Thick of it. Yeah. Viva La Bam. Viva La Bam is what I started with first.
Okay.
And that Bam had offered me the opportunity to live with him in Westchester and leave Baltimore.
Okay.
In hopes to get off heroin, start skating again, and him and I kind of pick up where we left off.
Gotcha.
That was the plan in theory. The old saying, you want to make God laugh, tell me your day's going to go.
Yeah.
It didn't go that way. Okay, let's put it in perspective here. My very first tattoo that I ever got, Edwin Bam, it was like, come move with me. We'll start skating again. You could be on Viva La Bam. You just got to stay off drugs. And I couldn't stay clean. And I'd make an excuse up that I had to go back to Baltimore to get my favorite pair of jeans. And I would just disappear in Baltimore for weeks. And he would give me another chance and I'd come back. But he was just trying to do the best that he could to understand a really not understandable problem to him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, dude, we're going to get you a tattoo. And it's going to say, no more fucking heroin. And every time you look at it before, hopefully you'll look at it and you'll not get high, which did not work. But that was my very first tattoo that I ever got right here.
That's hilarious.
So that was my
first tattoo ever.
Ever.
Wow.
Right out of the gate. Not like, you know, that's mom fantastic. Or girlfriend's initials.
Yeah,
no or like my side, like no more fucking heroin, big and bold.
Oh man, didn't work though.
No, clearly not.
Yeah.
If only it were that simple.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, that was my introduction to that world. And you know, it took a lot of tries and attempts, and I'd live with him. And I remember his parents even saying, Why do you keep letting Novak back? Like, he's going to hurt you. He's going to let you down. He's going to steal from you. He's going to lie to you.
Yeah.
And I did all that in abundance. And he would always give me another chance when he believed that I really wanted it. Mm. Not like, oh, sure, just come on back. But like, I had to show some effort. And it took ultimately, you know, but way later down the road than, way later than we all expected.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And so this Dream Seller was the book that I wrote while I was still getting high. And okay. I wrote this under the influence, like crazy. And the only reason why I wrote this book, I have no high school diploma at the time. I had no GED when I had written this, literally expelled from 11th grade as a direct result of my addiction.
Mm.
Cut to, I'm living at Bam's house. We're filming Viva La Bam. And every day we'd finish filming and we'd all go out, the cast and the crew, and we'd have a dinner at a bar. And it would be a table of, you know, 30 people or so, drinking, food, fun times. And he was always very entertained and amused by my stories of addiction, the places it put me in, the people it surrounded me with,
sure,
right? The choices that then became a life.
Yeah, I mean, still crazy stories.
Yeah, totally. And so he'd be like, tell this story, tell that story. And I would tell the story at a table of 30 or 40 in a bar, and you could hear a pin drop. So one day, Bam said, all right, new deal. Because at this time, he's letting me live with him. I can be on the TV show. I can get paid by Viacom. I can have a car. I can have a credit card. I just can't do heroin or opioids. I can do like cocaine and alcohol because it's socially acceptable and, you know, whatever. But no downers, because then I like steal shit. I total cars. I go to jail.
Mm.
So he said, all right, new rule. You're going to write a book. You're going to take a pen and a paper, and the moment that I don't see you, you don't have to be writing, but the first time that I don't see you with that pen and paper in your hand, you're going back to Baltimore. And I'm like, fuck, I don't want to write a book. Yeah. I have no desire. I don't even own a laptop. To this day, I got my first ever laptop during the beginning of COVID. And it was not by my design. My team said that I needed it for interviews.
Yeah, right.
And then I gave it to my treatment center that they use for Zoom shit. I don't email.
Yeah.
So I wrote this book. You can see on one of the picture pages, I wrote this book all pen and paper. And see the background of that?
Oh, yeah.
That's legit, like, yeah, the book. Yeah. Behind the pictures. I wrote the book, pen and paper.
That's wild.
I wrote it in 12 chapters. There's a guy named Joe Franz. Joe Franz filmed the CKY videos.
Okay.
Those are what Bam made his first million on.
Okay.
That's what began his career with being a household name. And Joe Franz filmed the CKY videos. Then Joe Franz became a filmer for Viva La Bams and then the Jackasses. But he was also a professor, really smart guy. So Bam tasked Franz with the position of being my co-author. And Franz is like, please do not do this to me.
Basically made him chief babysitter.
Legit. Nonetheless, I go to, right? No fool by any means, man. If I believe it, I can see it. All right, I don't want to write a book. I do love talking about these stories where heroin took me, because I can go back there without physically going back there.
Mm.
So it was this weird euphoric place that allowed me a little reprieve from being normal.
Yeah, sure.
I looked at as like a problem.
Right.
So I went to Barnes & Noble. No, a team captain from Element, my old team captain, Kingman, he gave me a book one day. He gave me a book called A Million Little Pieces by James Frey, which now has turned into a movie, but that book made it on Oprah's Book Club.
Yeah.
I loved that book. And his book was written in 12 chapters. So I copied his outline. I wrote it in 12 chapters. About a year later, I go to Bam and I'm like, I think I'm done. I didn't want to write the book, but I didn't want to go back to being homeless in Baltimore.
Yeah, right.
Like,
that sounds worse.
I'm becoming a household name. I'm getting paid by Viacom. I'm fucking use the money to get more drugs. Like, it's an amazing thing.
Right.
Just party, whatever. So yeah, I mean,
In terms of being like a 20-something-year-old addict, like, that's a pretty sweet setup. It's like the best way to do it, you know what I mean?
Which was probably terrible for my alcoholic brain, because if you look at it, the parallels of the role that I played in those movies and TV shows, as opposed to my addicted life,
yeah,
were a junkie's dream, right? Mm-hmm. The more outrageous my behaviors were, the more outlandish my antics became, the higher the ratings went, the more in demand I was, the more money I made, which then allowed me to buy more drugs. Right, just a wash, rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I write this book, and about a year later, I go to Bam, I think I'm done. And he reads it, like, fuck. So he gives it to Joe Franz. Joe Franz turns 12 chapters into 23 chapters.
Jeez.
We shop it around. Bam's agent at the time, Terry Hardy, gets me a literary agent because no one gives a fuck about who I am at that point. But Bam makes this happen, and a whole lot of no's, and we come to an agreement with Kensington Publishers, Citadel Press. And this book was recently revised in its 12th edition. Now, for people who don't really understand the literary world, which why would you if you don't? I didn't. 98% of books aren't revised past their first edition.
Yeah.
This is in its revised in its 12th edition.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the more revisions happen, they are continually excited about getting the book out. Correct?
This thing keeps selling and selling and selling. And so it became crazy successful. But I wrote under the influence. Then I went to treatment. And then I just wrote recently, I'd say a few years ago, the sequel to this, which is called The Streets of Baltimore, which just came out. And the reason why I'm getting into all this, and that book, which I also both did the narrations for, so you can get them on audiobook, me reading it, which is a really interesting fucking process. But The Streets of Baltimore talks about my psyche going through that whole process of Viva La Bam, Jackass, literally being handed the keys to this kingdom, all the while knowing underliningly that my addiction is going to rip this out from under me. Hmm. And although I want it so bad, I know that it's only temporary because it's only a matter of time before I go back to fucking like shooting her. And it happened.
Yeah.
But I really break down like what my mental state looked like. And that was depressing. Mm. That was doing all this rad shit, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Like hanging out at the Playboy Mansion, doing TRL with Jay-Z and Mariah Carey. And day that his album Best of Both Worlds dropped. And like really, and that's just the beginning of it, that to knowing that it's only temporary and that like.
And that even then,
I'll return back.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand at the time, but I know it now. I always underestimated the opponent that I was up against, meaning addiction, because I was too smart for my own fucking good. I couldn't understand why every time I got in the ring, I got beaten to a pulp. Not like, you know, a fat lip and a bruised eye. I'm talking like, eyes gouged out, teeth yanked out, tongue severed, skin off my face, like ears. And I couldn't understand because I was like an intelligent guy who could make things happen. And looking back, I see what happened. It's that I never, ever, ever gave my opponent, meaning my alcoholism or my addiction, the time, energy, or attention that it fucking deserved. Ever.
Yeah.
So therefore, of course, I'd beat me to a bloody pulp too if I saw some ignorant person that has no ability to have any kind of like chance to combat against what I'm going to put on. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like,
right.
What is it? Like the mouse and the cat kind of or whatever?
Well, it's kind of almost like a purposeful underestimation of your opponent as well, because I feel like you just like, you don't really want to stop. Like you want to stop, but you don't really want to stop.
Totally.
So you're like it's willful ignorance to go in underprepared to the battle because like you kind of want.
And there were times
you kind of want to be beat up.
And that's it. Totally. And there were times where I accepted the outcome.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? Actually, let's just get this done quicker.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I knew what was happening.
Yeah. It sounds like along the way you had a lot of strong, I guess, relationships, friendships with some of the guys that you were going through a lot of this stuff with, sound like Bam being one of them. How would you describe your friendships during that time and now?
You know, it's funny because the ones that I had in Baltimore, I had burnt every one of those to the bridge. So Baltimore wasn't like home to me anymore.
Okay.
And it hadn't been for a long time.
It was just a place to go get drugs.
Yeah. Even when I was there, it wasn't nothing like promising about it. But then when Bam gave me the opportunity to move to Westchester, and I showed up there, and Chris Rabb and Ryan Dunn and Rake Yan and his girlfriend Jen at the time, and they were doing like normal things that I had like long destroyed and hadn't experienced in so long, like hanging out at people's houses, going to bars, going to restaurants, going to the movies, right? I was so disconnected from that reality that when I got there, I was like, it really humanized me.
Yeah, sense of normalcy.
And I was so dehumanized for so long that people like literally felt that it was best to love me from a distance and cross the street when I was coming, rightfully so. Because if you told me you loved me, I had you. You know, I got you for at least $10, a place to stay, a car to drive, a credit card to steal. You know, and it's unfortunate. And it really is.
Give an inch, take a mile type of thing.
Because in my addiction, you know, if anyone attempted to stand between me and a drink or a drug, you had to go. And it was never personal. It was always just business.
Yeah.
Because I was a good guy who came from a good home, who knew right from wrong. But unfortunately, I was up against an opponent that I never stood a chance with.
Yeah.
And what I know to be true today is that anybody that's battling with addiction or alcoholism, here's a life hack. You're fighting a fixed fight. You'll never, ever, ever fucking win. More of that mind fuck. Little did I know, the moment that I came into sobriety and admitted complete defeat was the exact second I secured the ultimate victory. But that contradicted everything I lived my life by to that point.
Getting in the ring.
Yeah. The win is to fucking bow out.
Yeah.
Throw the towel in.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate victory. Accept responsibility for my actions. Stop trying to create a desired outcome. Like, just fucking buy into the process.
Yeah. How long during this time were you like actively on television when you were just high? Or would they like make sure that you weren't able to film that way, or was there precautions around that?
No, I mean, it was just, it's crazy because like in the beginning of Jackass, before it became really unionized, I remember Miller High Life used to sponsor Jackass, and we'd be wherever filming, and they'd literally have to rent out like 2 extra hotel rooms, same size as today's hotel rooms, for all the Miller High Life, like legit. And then as time progressed and people saw like, you know,
as it became a thing,
a very monetized thing where people were like doing very well off of,
right?
Like, yeah, maybe we should kind of cut that back so that, you know, but there were stunts, like a stunt that I was supposed to do that I ended up going to jail and couldn't make bail to get out, and someone else got to do that stunt. You know what I mean? So like, we started to get some repercussions from our actions along the way.
Sure.
I saw Steve-O talking recently about how he was supposed to do the branding in his ass.
Oh, yeah.
But Bam did it, where he branded it, whatever, in his ass. And the only reason why Bam did it is because, from what Steve-O said, is he was like doing nitrous oxide, and when they went to get him out of his hotel room, his face was like blue. So like, all right, you're going to sit this out.
Right. Was there a lot of that with all of the cast and crew? Was there a few people that were just like, they're dead sober the whole time? They're just there to hang out and film, or like?
No, there wasn't anyone that was dead sober. There was just normal people and not normal.
Normal
people.
Like alcohol, weed, cocaine.
Yeah, just have fun, go to work on a Monday morning, carry on with responsibilities.
Yeah, sure.
And then there were like
be able to show up and do their job.
And then there's like the Steve-O's and I, who just are like, fuck. Like, this is going to go for the whole duration.
Did you guys
filming.
Get along more because of that, you think?
Well, we get along way better now. We got along then, but it was really convoluted and just fogged with addiction. Now, he's a dear friend of mine, and I told him about this when I did his podcast not too long ago, but there was a point in time where I thought about asking him to be my sponsor in the program. And I'm
was he sober before?
Yeah, he's been sober longer than I.
Okay.
And he's like, he really is one of the people that I I emulate in a lot of ways as far as behaviors, actions, and being a good human being.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is insane to say if you think about it.
Yeah. Well, if you go watch Jackass 1, 2, 3, like, you know what I mean? You're not like, that's the role model.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Totally. But like when I thought about it, I'm like, dude, I don't know if I want to commit that much. Cause he's like really, I still have like my own issues as we all do.
Sure.
But
sure.
Some things I just don't want to address at the moment or whatever. Right. But like, you know, and that's funny. To think about.
Yeah, that ended up that way. Yeah.
He's doing great. And you know, I talked to a lot of them you know, when our paths cross or whatever the case is. Some I talk to way more, some I don't talk to at all.
Were there ever any stunts that you were approached with that you were like, fuck that?
No. Quite the contrary.
Really?
I was willing to do anything. Because here's why, right? I wasn't allowed to do downers, right? No heroin, no opiates, no pills. And everyone was well aware of that.
Okay.
But if I did a stunt, that means I got more screen time, which means I made more money. And if the stunt was crazy enough and I got hurt, I was taken to the hospital where a doctor would write me a script of what I really wanted, which was pain pills. And everyone allowed me to do that.
Because
it was a justifiable high.
Yeah, right,
and I did it while working. And everyone's stoked. I got, you know, the point of Jackass is to do things terribly wrong. So the worse the stunt went, the better, like, of an applause you got.
Right. Right. It gives you not only an excuse to take drugs, but also the, like, actual handwritten note from a medical doctor prescribing them to you.
Legit.
To recover from the injury that was self-inflicted in the first place. It's like the gift that keeps on giving, man.
As I'm saying, that the role that I played, the character I was, is like a junkie's dream.
Yeah, right. That's wild, like, looking back. Have you gone through any of this stuff, like the documentary, whatever, on the opiate crisis and stuff that's come out recently? Have you seen any of those?
I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. I didn't watch the one that came out. I think there's on Netflix or something. But it talks about the family that really basically, they were legal drug dealers, essentially. Like, they just fought to get a bunch of things passed that were
probably
insane
the
laws.
Purdue
lobbied,
with the Sackler and,
the
and
Sackler
all the,
family.
So financially driven and motivated.
It's insane, dude. It's
which
the
then
crazy
ties
thing is
into
that
political.
Family just like gets to chill with billions of dollars now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, they get slapped with some fines or whatever, maybe get some bad publicity, but it's like, you made a fortune off of getting like kids addicted to drugs for 30 years, you know,
which I believe
no repercussions for that.
Doctors, not all, but I believe a lot of doctors are worse than the heroin dealers you see on the corner.
Sure.
At least there, you know what you're getting, right? I see a lot of like 18-year-old Bryans who break their ankle playing lacrosse, and they go to the hospital, and because, you know, the doctor who's in a stethoscope and a white lab coat, and you know your insurance pays, you don't pay him, and it's financially incentivized. The more of these particular scripts he writes, the more money they make.
Yep.
So all of a sudden, Brian's got a sprained ankle, and here's some. Here's 30 days worth of Percocets.
Yeah.
And Brian says, cool, he takes it. He goes to Rite Aid, they fill it for free. There's nothing drug dealerish about
that.
And Brian starts taking those pills, and now Brian has built up a physical dependency on these pills. It's inevitable. It's going to happen.
Right.
And then one day the doctor says, well, Brian, your ankle's healed up. You don't need these anymore. Well, maybe so.
Yeah.
But tell that to his body, who now has a physical dependency and a mental obsession, and he can't stop thinking about it. So Brian leaves the doctor's office, and he starts buying oxys from his neighbor up the street for $80 a pop.
Yeah.
80 and 80 is 160. You're buying two of those a day, you're going to drain 18-year-old Brian's bank account out real quick. And then what happens is, you see Dave from up the street, who's always been that weird, shady guy that everyone stays away from. But Dave catches you on a day when you ran out of money, you can't buy any oxys. And Dave's got some heroin, and Dave's like, dude, what are you doing? $10 will get you higher than 480s. And then all of a sudden, that word heroin that was so taboo, all of a sudden becomes not so tabooish.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's,
that's
it's the
same progression.
Drug.
That's it.
That's what's wild. That it seems just so blatantly, egregiously wrong that they were just writing prescriptions
for sure.
Stupid shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not even stuff that would even require that much of a painkiller.
Not at all.
You know what I mean? And it derailed a lot of people's lives completely. Mm-hmm. Just just for some money, you mm-hmm. know? It's wild. It's wild to look at. And now like, you know, I think they've gotten that under control. Speaking anecdotally from my own experience, like I've never been prescribed anything like that. And I've been in and out of the hospital a good amount with different surgeries and stuff when I was growing up, just from playing sports. I just got a lot of injuries. And they would never give me anything like that because of my age. Because they were just like, oh, you're a 16-year-old male. You fit like right into this demographic
sure.
that we are not allowed to like write these prescriptions to. So even if it was like, I went back one time when it was just like, I was in a lot of pain. My ankle got infected after I had reconstruction surgery. And I went back and was like, this stuff is not working. It was like Norco, but it was like pretty mm-hmm. chill Norco, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was taking them. I would take some ibuprofen. I was like, I'm in pain. Like this is not working is what I'm telling you. And the doctor was still like, no, we can't. Like,
and thank God for that doctor.
Yeah, sure, sure.
At
the time, I was like,
sure.
I want something stronger than
totally.
This, though, you know? But like now I look back on it, it's like, yeah, but like you don't know the fire that you're playing with when you're a 16-year-old kid just trying to recover from a sports injury so you could get mm-hmm. back and play. Like you don't know any of that. You just want to feel a little bit better. You know what I mean? You just want to be out of the pain.
And then there's a lot of doctors where you'll go to them and say, look, I'm in recovery. I'm sober. I can't take any narcotic. And they'll try. And it's happened to me. And a lot of people that I sponsor that do it. And they try to hand it over and over and
really?
Over. It's like, don't.
Yeah, I just told you.
Like over and over.
Out of my
yeah. And then someone else comes in and tries to hand
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Talk about your mind screwing you in that situation too. Because like we talked about, it's a medical doctor. They went to like
yeah,
12 years of school
sure.
to be able to be qualified to tell you to take this drug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're, of course you're going to like look for every reason to just be like, ah, fuck it.
Yeah.
It's only,
totally.
It's only 20 days worth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'll
justify
be done
in any
weeks,
way, shape
you know
or form. I mean?
Yeah. Right.
My body doesn't understand or recognize take one as prescribed. Like that's right. fucking foreign to me. I have a better
yeah,
chance
do
of
not
learning
use
how to
alcohol.
Read.
Yeah. Okay.
Totally.
Oh man. Well, listen, dude, this has been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed this,
taking,
man.
Yeah, taking
this
the time
was rad.
To be on the show.
We went a direction I didn't expect. That was really a beautiful thing we just did here.
Good, man. I'm good. Glad to hear that. Is there what you got going on now? What are you working on?
Just so I created the Novax Houses, which are men's sober living houses, and my goal is to provide scholarships for any man in need, as long as I have a bed available. And I do that by asking generous donors if they'd like to contribute to the cause. Whether it's a dollar, a penny, 5 cents, $5, it doesn't matter. Anything's better than nothing. And if you're interested in that cause, you could just Venmo it to at Novax House.
At Novax House
yeah,
on Venmo.
Yeah, it's real simple. But I also help people get help. I've opened up Redemption Addiction Treatment Center. I'm a firm believer that I could create the environment that I seek, and I've devoted my life to helping people who are where I was and don't see a light at the end of that dark tunnel. So if anyone's out there and they need help, they can reach me and my partner directly at 610-314-6747. And we'll do the best that we can to get you the help that you deserve. So check it out. The books, they're in audio. If you go to my website, brandonnovak.com, it kind of takes you down the whole rabbit hole of all my stuff.
Sweet, man. BrandonNovak.com. Dude, thanks so much for coming on. Thank you for the work that you are doing.
Love it, man.
And continue to do. Appreciate you.
Thank you, bro.
We'll
this
do
was rad.
Some time. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Cheers.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet. Then leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.